My name is Sanjeev Gupta, and this is Socialism in the Time of Corona. In this podcast, I'm talking with people with deep experience in socialist and left politics, especially in the US. Our overarching question is, during this pandemic, how might we not only defend whatever gains we've made to this point, but actually advance them? Following my conversation with Ruth Milkman about millennials in episode 4, I became interested in the origins of people's interest in socialism or the left generally. In a series of 3 episodes this week, I asked guests to reflect on the links between their life experiences and their current political activity. The last round of this conversation features Rose Bookbinder, who is co-director and organizer at the Pioneer Valley Workers Center. She is also a member of the United Auto Workers and serves on the interim board for the Western Mass Area Labor Federation. We discussed the perversity of food insecurity during the pandemic among the essential workers who are putting food on everyone else's tables, the difference between workers' centers and unions, and some reasons for hope over the next few years. I began by asking Rose about how she got started in politics and organizing.
I guess there's a few different routes that got me to this moment of having the honor to get to be one of the co-directors at the Pioneer Valley Workers Center. I, first of all, grew up with a long lineage of activists in my family that I think is rooted in our Jewish tradition of believing that our calling, and for my family, in our religion was social justice. We're not religious. In fact, most of my family have been atheist Jews, but the way that we connect with our spirituality is through social justice work. So I think that's really been a foundational part of my life. And I had, you know, both parents and grandparents who brought me into the streets or, you know, talked to me about inequalities in our community from a young age. And I think right now, hopefully that's happening in a lot of households across the country right now. So we're building a whole new generation of activists to build a better world. But I grew up, you know, with mostly a single mom. My dad was in the picture, but, you know, saw the realities of what it was like to have a single mom who struggled financially. We did have some support from her family, but still there was a lot that I needed to do to support the family. And I, as soon as I was able to work, I got a job in the restaurants. I actually grew up here in Western Mass, so got jobs working in restaurants, both back of the house, and then eventually worked my way up to be a waitress. I was a busser and dishwasher and things like that, but then became a waitress. And I saw the very different ways that workers were treated in a workplace from a young age, and recognized my privilege as a white woman and the way that I was able to move up in the restaurant. And, you know, luckily was in some fine dining restaurants where I was able to get pretty significant tips that, you know, supported me in college. But I saw very different, stark differences in the ways that predominantly undocumented immigrants were treated in the workplace. And not only by the boss, but by my coworkers and also by the people who came to eat at the restaurants. So that has really informed a lot of my paths in life, and especially growing up here in Western Mass with such a vibrant food justice movement, I quickly saw that that was dominated by predominantly white people or academics or people who were in control of the food system rather than the workers who were actually growing the food, serving the food, packing the food, selling the food in retail stores or in restaurants or at farms. And so anyways, I'm talking a lot, but
no, it's hard.
When I got myself to college, the food service workers on my campus were organizing a union, and I was part of some activist circles, and I had also recently started an internship at a local workers' center where I was actually getting to know some of these workers in other situations in the community, and so quickly got involved to support these workers that were organizing a union. And it was just when the Iraq war was starting, and so a lot of the people on our campus were feeling like they needed to do something, and we were definitely engaged in anti-war actions, but we walked, I think it was like February 15th, 2002 or three, I guess. I'm forgetting when the war started, but, and then, you know, we had some of the largest rallies and uprisings in history all over the world to oppose the Iraq war. And then just a few days later, the first bombs hit. And I think many people, you know, many young people just felt like at a loss of how could this be? Like, we just participated in some of the largest uprisings in recorded history, yet our country still went to war. And so on my campus, when the workers started organizing, it felt like such a powerful way to actually make an impact and make a change right on our own campus, and that we held power to support the workers. And so I helped to organize some pretty major rallies, and we participated in hunger strikes and helped boycott the dining services to support the workers. And eventually they won their union. And I think seeing what a difference when workers are empowered and with a union contract that can make, and how that power spreads and how that spreads into their families. And then, you know, other workers learn about the power that they can have to make change in their workplace was sort of what got me into worker organizing. That was a very long way of saying that. But.
No, it's actually a really succinct, you know, description of a rich and already, I mean, I know you're not, you know, I'm actually going to ask you about millennials as well, but it's already a long life of activism. So I wasn't going to go to sort of the Iraq war, but you know, the way you characterized it, and yes, I remember in for the second one, you know, it may have actually been the largest protest movement in history, you know, in terms of the numbers of people who came out all over the world, and the war still happened, and then obviously it wasn't the last war. So I guess I want to try to think aloud with you about what's happening now with, you know, the protests that we're seeing now, which also in some ways are maybe significantly escalated compared to previous ones. And what do you make of this? What's going to, you know, what should or can come out of it?
Mm-hmm. I think I have more questions than answers at this moment. I'm just shocked by what I'm seeing, you know, through live streams and firsthand accounts and reports from just the extreme state violence that we're seeing. I mean, people are literally being shot dead for exercising their democratic right to protest. And not that I believe that those rights are being respected at any point in reality, but it's a really powerful moment in which I think there's so much at stake and there's so much solidarity that could be built right now. But I also just feel a tremendous amount of fear. And that's, again, recognizing the privilege that I have, that I'm able to work from home right now. Something that I think is missing for me as an organizer is just the power of sitting in a room with other people to strategize about what we do next. And while I took to the streets yesterday in Northampton with thousands of other people, in which was really the first time I've been around other people in that way, it's confusing to me to figure out, you know, what our strategy needs to be to push back against the repression. And it's extreme violence, where, you know, we're seeing tankers literally going down roads, pushing protesters, you know, back from the line that they're approaching. But also there's been all these beautiful mutual aid networks set up because we're in this pandemic moment. And so folks, I think, are more organized than maybe they were when the Iraq war started, because we've been creating these networks of support, which can quickly, hopefully, convert to networks of strategy building and organizing to push back against the repression. And I think people are seeing, because we're all being affected by this pandemic, that people are seeing that we need each other more than ever. And they're seeing the state failing to provide what it needs for us to survive. And that actually we, the people, are capable of providing what we need through these food distributions that have been happening, through these, you know, care of people who have COVID, with dropping off medicine or food to our neighbors. And so I'm hopeful that we're on the brink of building something better and toppling what's been, you know, oppressing us for centuries. And I hope that folks, especially white folks, can realize that it's a time to show solidarity, but to really take direction by those who have been most impacted by structural racism and white supremacy and all of these things, and give space to those folks to lead us in this moment. But I still have a lot of questions and a lot of fear, like just seeing what's going on. And also recognizing that we're in a pandemic in which, like, maybe in 2 weeks, there's going to be another major outbreak of people being sick because folks are fed up and they're righteously angry and they want to be in the streets together expressing that. But it's very difficult to practice any sort of social distancing. I mean, there was just thousands of people just in Northampton on one block with really no social distancing, except people were wearing masks. But I mean, they weren't wearing N95 masks or face shields. They were just cloth masks. So I think we're going to have another round of really sick people to go with the uprisings, which is scary in itself.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, I'm realizing that I could, at this point, get very easily, I'd say, distracted into a whole other conversation about this. And, you know, and perhaps we should have that conversation. So I'm going to try to discipline myself to come back to, you know. And so, you know, last or a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to Ruth Milkman, who's a sociologist, and she, you know, she specifically studied millennials in some of her recent work. Would you call yourself a millennial? Is that something you think of yourself as?
I don't. Like, I guess that is what I am. I'm 36. No, I think I'm 30.
You don't have to say.
But I think that is what I am. I think I'm on, like, the line of
You're at the edge. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm at the edge. But yeah, I think I don't usually refer to myself as that. But I think technically I am. I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. No, the reason I asked is because, you know, in her work and then in a few studies I've seen, you know, we put a lot of emphasis on the particular experiences of millennials. And of course, you've had your share as a restaurant worker and so on. But the focus of the stuff I've read, at least, has often been on, you know, other movements that have happened over that time, like, you know, Occupy and so on. Mm-hmm. And it's really striking in your case that it may be a combination of that and this what I'd call a very traditional American account of having a family, you know, especially a Jewish family in your case, mm-hmm. And that's a big, seems to be a big part of the story, in addition to, you know, your particular experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that has had a big impact on me, and just the fact that I worked in restaurants for 10 years, and that was a profound, you know, and I kind of came back and forth to it at different points, and that was just a profound experience for me, especially this is sort of a weird thing, but I actually like find myself to be kind of a foodie from that experience, learning so much about food. But then also just all the ways that so many folks in our food system don't have access to the food that they're growing or serving, and how unjust and unfair just that is, that folks in our food system experience food insecurity at much higher rates than any other group of workers. Hmm. It's just so unjust that they are interacting with all the beauty that is what nourishes us, but can't access it for themselves or their family. And I think that's what really drew me to being a part of starting the Worker Center, was that we live in this Connecticut River Valley that has some of the richest soil in the country, and we have so much joy around that, yet so much pain and suffering associated with it right in our Happy Valley.
So then that does lead to one of the questions I sent you ahead of time, is why a worker center? You know, you're also a member of the UAW, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've obviously been involved in union activism as well. So can you tell us about what role workers' centers play that, you know, is different from unions, or that makes it easier for you to do the kinds of work you want to do with people who are working in the food industry than, you know, yeah, basically just conventional unions?
Sure. So I spent many years as a union organizer, and I think I mentioned earlier, spent some of my first work in terms of like an internship at a workers' center. And I saw both value in both of the types of organizing, and wanted to figure out how to sort of unite each of those places and where I saw fault in each. And what I mean by that is my time spent at this worker center in Westchester County, which supported predominantly day laborers in the construction industry, had, whenever I was working there, it was a few days a week, you know, we couldn't keep the door shut. People were walking in constantly, needing support, wanting to access the English language classes or learn about, you know, jobs that they could get in the community, or to fight back against employers who didn't pay them or underpaid them. And there was such a strong community associated with that worker center and such a growing base of workers. And we were able to solve a lot of the problems. We would file a Department of Labor claim and get the money back from a contractor who didn't pay the workers for 2 weeks of work. But then a couple months later, another worker would walk in from that same construction site with the same issue. And it just felt like a Band-Aid over and over. We weren't solving the systemic problem. We were just fixing the finite issue of like wages being stolen. But there was this like large community that was part of the workers' center. So it was like kind of seeing that wonderful part of it, but also recognizing that there wasn't long lasting change being created. And it's not to say that that isn't important work, but that did frustrate me. And so then when I started organizing with the food service workers at my college and saw that they won a contract that was legally binding and that that contract would be reviewed, you know, every year, every few years, depending on the length of the contract, and that they could not only create systemic change within their workplace, but actually improve it with each new contract. I was just, you know, really happy to see that and see that that there could be actual power built with the workers. But as I was doing new organizing and we would show up at workers' doors and say that we were from the union and wanted to talk with them, we would have the door slammed in our face. Such a different experience than this open door at the workers' center. And, you know, some of that, yes, is at the fault of unions and not doing the community and social justice work that they should always be doing. But a big part of that is the ways that the laws in this country have been built and the far right attacks on unions and successful messaging to workers that unions are an outside third party and, you know, all the anti-union rhetoric that's spilled into workers and the fear that they have of organizing. And so I just had always been wondering, like, how can we sort of incorporate these two things? How are we building community, but also creating systemic and long-lasting change? So when we started the worker center, there were a lot of food system workers at the table. There was UMass Amherst Labor Center. There were some lawyers who do wage theft cases. And then there were unions and also our central labor councils, thinking about how do we create a center that's based on organizing and also helping to incubate new organizing and building that community, but then passing that community on to unions to then organize in those workplaces. And so that's what sort of brought us to the Workers' Center and its sort of foundation, which is that while we do know that in order for people to feel like they can take the risk of organizing, they need their material needs met, you know, and we do provide services, a very big component is actual, like, how are we passing reforms at the legislative level, whether local or state or federal, that really help to create avenues for organizing. So while we passed a wage theft ordinance in Northampton and Springfield, which again are sort of band-aids, we've used those as opportunities to meet leaders and folks who are experiencing wage theft, and then think about how we take collective action to deal with those wage theft issues. And ideally, hopefully, you know, once they win those wage theft cases, then we are connecting to unions who might want to organize in those workplaces for long-lasting change through union contracts.
I see. So it's not so much that workers or this worker center is, you're not seeing it as an alternative or a competitor. It's meeting immediate needs that unions aren't, both in terms of material needs as well as, you know, organizing capacity and interest needs. But the part of the aim is to then get people out back into the union sphere as organizers.
Yeah, exactly. And to help push a more social justice left, you know, union movement that is incorporating in low wage immigrant people of color, Black workers that have, you know, not that there are a lot of union members that are people of color. I don't want to say that, but there also have been a lot that have been left out from the union movement. And there's a long history of racism within the union movement that we can't push aside or forget. And there's a lot of work that still needs to be done in order to build a multiracial union movement that's not just led by, you know, white men, which it's not all that way, but there's a lot of it and there's a lot of growth to happen. And I think, you know, we see the Worker Center as helping to move in that direction.
And do you have sort of evidence that this is in fact happening? And I'm not asking for specifics that would, you know, expose anyone, but do you have knowledge of people who've come out of the workers' center and then, you know, gone into unions to do the kind of work that you know the workers' center is aiming for?
Yeah, we've successfully had some unions form out of workplaces that we've supported, and we're in the midst of a few large campaigns in supporting that as well. I do just want to say, like, that is a big part of our work. We also are doing solidarity economy work and forming worker co-ops as another model of workplace democracy. And, you know, the work is really quite large at the Worker Center, but I'm sort of focusing in on this because that's, you know, the topic that you are really interested in speaking about. But I don't want to just minimize to say that that's like the whole Worker Center, you know, but that is a particular angle that I am very excited to be a part of as, you know, both a union member and a union organizer for many years is how can worker centers be a part of building worker power, both through creative mechanisms, but also through building the union movement.
Well, I'd certainly love to talk with you about co-ops as well, and and the other work that the center is doing. You're right. Right now, this actually kind of started very arbitrarily in May. That's when I started the podcast, and in my mind, like, you know, May, Labor Day, so a nice whole, like, sort of, became sort of themed around that. But certainly co-ops are part of that. And, if you have time for another conversation, yeah, you know, we can certainly do that. But just to continue this track a little bit, sure, in general, do you see the sort of, workers' centers generally that you know of, do you see this social justice kind of orientation kind of more generally among workers' centers? And then is that something you would point to as a difference with unions again in general, or is that the wrong way to sort of ask the question?
I think that there are a mix of different types of worker centers, and I think they all play important roles. We have built relationships and alliances with worker centers that are similar to ours, that are interested in really organizing and building power for workers and making, you know, local, state, national changes. I think there are a number of worker centers across the country who do more servicing, whether it's immigration support or dealing with, you know, workplace issues, but not necessarily on the organizing track, more just like dealing with violations of the law and handling those through legal cases and things like that. Some of them I'm sure are doing, some of them I know are doing class action lawsuits, but again, not around organizing, but just winning back what was stolen, for example, from the workers. And I think that's true for the labor movement as well. We have, you know, unions that have a tilt towards social justice and negotiating contracts for their workplaces, but then also being part of building a social movement beyond just the bread and butter issues of their contracts. And we have others that's not what they're interested in doing. And I don't fault either worker centers or unions, you know, that aren't doing that. I think we are constantly fighting against all of the ways that, like, if you just look at one workplace and you're constantly having to put out fires, you're filing grievances, you're dealing with, you know, states that are trying to file right to work laws, you're dealing with bosses that are abusive, and you're just constantly putting out fires. And there's only so much energy that each person can actually produce, you know, if they're also, yeah, like, as an organizer or as a representative for a union, you know, they can only do so much. And if you're constantly having to fight back, it's difficult to think about the vision of what you're building as well. And so that's why I am hopeful in this moment that something new is going to be built, because we are so often having to put out fires and not getting to be creative about the world that we all know that we deserve. And it's exhausting on so many levels, but we need to take that time to envision the beautiful things we can create and not just always be fighting back. And I think that's why a lot of our co-op development work and our solidarity economy work is so fulfilling, because it's about exploring the ways that we can take back what has always been ours, whether it's, you know, the land to grow food, or childcare collectives, or things like that, that are, you know, what things that bring us joy is in creating.
Yeah, well said. So the other big question I sent you earlier is actually about the workers' center work during the pandemic, and how, what if there are any big differences between what you all are doing now compared to before the pandemic, and feel free to, you know, make pitches as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had to shift a lot in this moment of COVID. I'm like extremely thankful that we created systems that could very nimbly be changed. We, back in 2016, when Trump was elected, created this Solidarity in the Streets network that has a number of committees with volunteers on them that, you know, were doing a rideshare program. We were doing a food distribution, a childcare collective, a research committee, court accompaniment, a fundraising team, all of these things to help fight back against what we knew was coming with the Trump presidency around immigration raids and workplace abuse and things like that. And so that network was able to quickly shift to respond to COVID-19 and to also expand that to incorporate more the Western Mass Area Labor Federation, which is the umbrella group of unions in Western Mass. And we've been partnering with them and other labor unions to really develop this solidarity in the streets, which we've now done with probably almost 2,000 people doing worker assemblies, originally every week, then switching to every other week, where we're learning about the resources that are available, educating ourselves, and organizing together. And we were originally doing one food distribution a week, but then quickly expanded, one food distribution a month, and then shifted to do two a week, because we have, you know, these two groups of membership, one which is what we call like our solidarity members, who are, you know, many of them workers, but, you know, some of them academics, and many of them citizens who have more privilege. And then our other base of members, who are predominantly undocumented immigrants working in restaurants and farms, who were experiencing extreme food insecurity and really having no resources because our state has failed to provide, you know, any relief checks to folks who, even though they are paying taxes, you know, got nothing. They didn't get the $1,200 check that many of us got. And they also cannot get unemployment. And so we had a large membership, now around 400 people that are coming twice a week to get food. And for many of them, it's the only food that they're bringing into their homes, because they have a lot of fear about going to food pantries, just because of, this is a little bit complicated, but that Trump, this succeeded in the Supreme Court, this idea of public charge. And if you're deemed a public charge, then you can never get any sort of status in our country. So if you accept food stamps or things like that, so they've been afraid to go to these places. So because we've built this community, they feel safe to come and get food from the workers' center. And then we also, and there's an amazing team of, I think, over 60 volunteers that are helping to make that possible with donations from local farms and from the River Valley Co-op. And we've distributed, I think, probably almost 1,000 masks, face shields, and gloves to both people who are now starting to go back to work and their employers have not been providing them, or to people who just need to be out and about and need masks to go to the store or walk in the streets, things like that. And then we also quickly created what we call the 413 UNDOCU Solidarity Fund, which we are just like overjoyed by the amount of money it's raised. It's raised over $220,000, and we've dispersed, by this week, we will disperse $210,000 to nearly, or a little over 600 families who are in need of this money in order to pay rent and pay their bills. So it's been a tremendous amount of work, and such an important thing to be doing in this moment is doing this mutual aid work that is critical to people's survival and being able to put food on their table. And then also all the while, you know, really organizing, especially to make sure that workers in farms and restaurants are getting the proper PPE that they need to be protected, and thinking with them about what they need to feel safe in their workplace if they're going back to work. So we've been helping to organize with workers in their workplaces around how to demand what they need to feel safe.
Wow. And you're still taking donations for the UNDOCU Fund, right?
Yeah, folks can go to pvworkerscenter.org, and right on that front page, there's a link to donate to the fund. And, you know, we are just doing our second round of funds. And just as we get more money, we'll continue to do more rounds to support folks, because, you know, we know that this isn't, you know, this is going to continue for a while. Even those of us who are experiencing privilege of not having to work in, you know, essential workplaces, as, you know, working in supermarkets or as nurses or doctors or as, you know, trash collectors, all of these folks who are having to continue to work. But even in what we're experiencing, the fear of getting sick, of having our family members get sick, there's a lot of trauma, which makes it hard to envision what's next, you know. But I have a hard time imagining we're going to go back to whatever we were at before. And I'm just feeling hopeful that something new is coming. And I don't, so it's like hard to place where Trump fits in that, you know, mm-hmm. just because we're in a global pandemic. And I just, yeah, I just have a lot of questions, I guess.
You know, on balance, I think given our experience over the last few years, that's probably better than having a lot of answers that yeah. are wrong.
Yes.
I think you've captured probably what a lot of us are trying to figure out is how do you, especially if you've if you come from a political sort of experience or background where you know that the choices we have typically on offer really aren't choices, or are choices, you know, which are sort of just, yeah, between a Band-Aid and not. And yet, like, in a moment where, you know, it really may be the difference between, like, fatally, I don't know, this is carrying the Band-Aid analogy a little too far, but, you know, the difference between, like, a fatal injury and, you know, and just surviving to fight the next day. But anyway, that's,
Yeah, it's true. And I just hope that in this, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, we have to like look to our ancestors. We have to, you know, look at our elders in our community for support and answers, but also I hope that there's a lot of listening that happens and humility as well accompanied with that, you know, respecting the seasoned organizers or organizations and looking to them for guidance, but then also some humility and openness to what's being cracked open and new leaders and younger leaders helping to also shape what's next. Because it's also easy when you've been in this work for so long to think like, oh, I've got the answers. But I mean, nobody's experienced anything like what we're experiencing right now. So there's a lot to learn and a lot to explore together and experiment with to figure out what this opening can be.
Well, that kind of says it all, doesn't it? There's really not much to add to that. Individually and taken together, these three conversations have firmed up both my hope and resolve. I hope they do the same for you if you need that. Next week, I talk with Claire Hammonds about safety among essential workers during the pandemic here in Western Massachusetts. The week after that features Cedric Johnson, author of Trumpism, Policing, and the Problem of Surplus Population, a chapter in the book Labor in the Time of Trump, co-edited by Hammonds and others at the Labor Center at UMass Amherst. Join us in thinking aloud about how our day-to-day work during Corona can cohere into a battle plan for democratic socialism after it.